The document dated July 4th, 1776 begins with these words: "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them." It is a declaration. It is the Declaration of Independence, of course. But Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis says, take a close look at what the declaration is not. He says it's not a declaration of unity or cohesion. In fact, Ellis believes July 4th, 1776 is not the day the United States became a nation. Rather, he wants us to look a little later, to 1783, when four founding fathers undertook what he calls the most creative and consequential act of political leadership in American history. That idea is at the heart of Ellis's latest book. It's called The Quartet, Orchestrating the Second American Revolution, 1783 to 1789. And Joseph Ellis joins us now. Thanks for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. So the Second American Revolution, why? What happens in 1783 to 1789 that deserves such a title, such a mantle?
Well, the period, the 1780s, is a kind of black hole in American history. Nobody knows what happens then. Most Americans, even historically literate Americans, don't. And the person most responsible for the misunderstanding is Abraham Lincoln.
Mr. Lincoln?
Mr. Lincoln.
And why?
What do you think is the most famous speech in American history, Megan?
The one I had to memorize in, let's say, what was it, the sixth grade, the Gettysburg Address.
And the first clause in the first sentence, see if you can come along with me. 47 years ago,
our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation. Conceived in liberty.
And dedicated to the proposition
that all men are created equal.
And the last part lets you know that 47 is 1776, right?
Right.
And the answer to his question, you know, he's wrong. America doesn't create a nation in 76. It creates a confederation of sovereign states provisionally united to win the war and then go their separate ways, which is what they do.
In fact, there's nothing in the Declaration that calls America a united nation.
No. In fact, when people talk about the United States, they talk about it as a plural noun. The United States are, okay? Mm-hmm. And the resolution for independence voted on July 2nd from the Virginia delegation is, this is what they voted on, it is the formal Declaration of Independence, that these colonies are and have every right to be independent states.
Right.
We don't rebel as a nation. We rebel as a confederation of sovereign states. And the reason that Lincoln has to get it wrong is because the position that is historically correct is the position of the Confederacy in 1861.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. He couldn't actually look to true history because he would be supporting...
He's got to get history wrong in order to be morally right.
Okay. Well, you know, we could spend an hour talking about whether or not Abraham Lincoln, you know, how calculated he was in doing that, which obviously he
persuaded himself it was true.
Okay. So let's go back then that fourscore prior to the mid-19th century. The battles of the revolution are over, but there is this political battle that 13 loosely confederated states are undergoing.
That's right. And basically, all the energies from the end of the war onward are centrifugal rather than centripetal. Everything is spreading out. Nobody, if you think about it, the argument they've been making against the king and parliament is we don't want to be represented by any faraway government.
So why would they want that?
Why
right
would
here
they want to create at a time when the average American is born, lived out his or her life, and dies within a 28-mile radius? Government is local. Government is what you can see with your own eyes and trust because you're a neighbor, and he's a neighbor, or she's a neighbor. So the creation of any kind of government located far away seems to be inherently tyrannical, and seems to repeat the very mistakes they think they've avoided in the Revolution. Anyway, that's the direction that history's headed. We're headed towards the EU. It's going to be the American Union. It's going to be a confederation of sovereign states. And obviously, something happens to change that direction. And I'm arguing that this is one of those cases where, well, we always prefer change to come from the bottom up.
Right.
This comes from the top down.
And it comes from the top down in your book, in your view of this history, from what you call the quartet.
Right.
George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison. And basically what we're talking about is their influence in terms of what becomes the Constitution
right.
of the United
That's
States
right.
of America. Now, it's so interesting to me because you're right. Like, we kind of, in most classes, we skip from roughly 1776 then to 1789-ish.
Right, right.
But in that interim period, I mean, I'm looking at, for example, John Jay was talking about the Articles of Confederation at the time, which ends up getting wiped off the table. He says he's looking forward to evils and calamities in terms of the future.
They think that the Confederation is about to dissolve. European pundits abroad, especially in England, are looking forward to the dissolution of America so they can come back and recover what they lost in the war. There is a pretty clear consensus that anarchy or civil war is in the making.
I mean, Washington even says in a speech around this time that civil discord could lead to a deluge, a deluge over the rising empire of the United States, a deluge in blood.
Yeah, and one of the little insurrections out here in the western part of our Commonwealth called Shays' Rebellion mm-hmm. is a kind of triggering event. They exaggerate the significance of that. I live out there, so we know how it feels to be a colony out there in Boston.
And some things never change.
No, they don't. But it's used as a triggering event because it seems to be a harbinger of future anarchy. And these four guys end up first forcing the calling of a convention, making sure Washington participates. That's a big deal. He legitimizes this. Controlling the agenda, writing the Federalist Papers to manage the ratification process, and then single-handedly Madison writes the Bill of Rights.
Right.
So that's in the book, what I'm arguing they do to get us to the government. The government is a semi-national government. The U.S. is still not a nation in 1788-89. I don't think it becomes a nation until after the Civil War.
Right.
But it's a federal structure in which you can argue about the relationship between church and state deliberatively rather than violently.
Well, can we just talk for one second about Washington? I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's funny because he's probably the best known of the quartet, but maybe not for all the right reasons, because we talk about his role in the war, in the revolution. And, you know, as you lay plain in the book, he took a lot, even though he was concerned, deeply concerned about the direction the nation was heading, if it wasn't heading towards this more federal system.
Right.
He took a lot of lobbying to sort of come on board and be the figurehead.
He really didn't want to do it. He, when he became president, no president in American history did not want to be president than George Washington.
You write in the book that he said, he finds the occupation of rural life on Mount Vernon so congenial with my feelings that to be drawn into public life at this advanced age would be a sacrifice that could afford no compensation.
Remember, too, he surrenders his sword at the end of the war and becomes the American Cincinnatus, the Roman general that retires swords into plowshares. Once Cincinnatus retires, he can never go back. Mm. That's what Washington is saying. It takes a lot to convince him to come back. And what they end up convincing him is his own legacy is at stake.
Yeah. So in the book, The Quartet, you mean you write in beautiful detail about sort of the political machinations and process by which these four go through to get to what becomes the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, as you write. It's not a perfect document by any means,
no.
A stretch of the imagination. It's not what Alexander Hamilton wanted. But completely. But I wonder, I mean, to just take a quick step back in the last little bit of time that we have, you write so wonderfully about the quarrelsome process, essentially, that was the formation of the Constitution and how essential that is to what we recognize today as American democracy. I mean, not so much of what it looks like on paper, but what it was in practice.
Mm.
That was our first sort of view of it.
Yeah, it is. The Constitution doesn't provide answers. It provides arguments. Argument is the answer. It creates a framework in which the arguments can continue. The whole notion of original intent doesn't work because the original intent is not to hold any generation in the future hostile to their version of the answer. So they want to prolong the period of intense deliberation. The Constitution established not a democracy, but a republic. A republic is committed to the public interest, not the popular interest. The popular interest is short range. The public interest is long range. It filters the popular interest through layers of deliberation. That's the secret of a republic against a democracy. But anybody that looks back has to be impressed with the leadership at this moment, which might be the most consequential act of leadership in American history.
Joseph Ellis is a historian and a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His book is The Quartet, Orchestrating the Second American Revolution, 1783 to 1789. Professor Ellis, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.